Your boat is forecast for the Monterey Bay. West winds 10 knots in the evening, then becoming light. Wind waves less than 2 feet and a western swell of 2 to 4 feet at 10 seconds. And, of course, some patchy fog after midnight. Currently, it's 76 degrees in San Jose, 76 in Boulder Creek, 64 in Watsonville, 65 in Salinas, 64 in Monterey. And right now, outside the KSCO studios, it's a nice 65 degrees. And now, stay tuned for It's the Way of Love Live.
It's the Way of Love Live.
Hey, of love.
The variety show committed to bringing you positive, life-affirming messages.
Combined with enough inspirational music and satirical comedy to make it worth everyone's while.
With informative interviews and dynamic guests, we present the best of what our global community has to offer.
In a format we lovingly call short attention span theater, we combine vaudevillian styles with futuristic sound effects technology for maximum entertainment value.
Together we focus on the most important issues of the day by exploring informed and enlightened approaches wherever we can find them.
Using serialized fiction, we bring to life great stories from the past and sci-fi possibilities of the future.
Thank you for joining us in our multimedia foray into the positive possibilities of our planet.
Hang on. You never know what to expect.
Here we go. It's the Way of Love Live.
Good afternoon to you. You're listening to It's the Way of Love Live with me, Ruth Copland. We got some great guests for you today, so keep it on KSCO AM 1080.
Born a poor young country boy, Mother Nature's son. All day long, I'm sitting singing songs for everyone.
Mother Nature's Son by the Beatles, of course. And there's a couple of reasons I chose that to play today. The first is we've got a little bit of a miniature Brit invasion today on It's the Way of Love Live because my first guest, Paula Granger, is also from Britain. But also we have a bit of a theme of Mother Nature today. The first guest that we have is Paula Granger, who is a herbalist, medical herbalist and natural health expert. And she's from Britain, but she's now based in Santa Cruz, and we're going to be hearing a lot of interesting things from her. After her, we'll be talking in the second hour to Anne-Marie Sayers, who is one of the caretakers of Indian Canyon. And so we'll also be hearing about humans' connection to the earth from a different perspective from her. So without more ado, I'd like to welcome Paula. She's here in the studio. Good day to you.
Good day, Ruth.
So just a little bit of background on Paula. She graduated from the University of Westminster with a first-class honours degree in herbal medicine, and she then set up her own herbal apothecary, Lemon Balm, in London. She's also a member of the National Institute of Medical Herbalists, which is one of the most venerable associations for professional herbalists in the world. She has a passion for herbs. In London, she ran regular herb walks. She's now in Santa Cruz. She's doing the same thing here. And I'm very excited to find out more about what you're doing here. So first I should ask you, how did you end up here, Paula?
Well, it's kind of a coincidence, really. We were on holiday, on vacation, driving up from L.A. to San Francisco. We came into Santa Cruz just for a couple of nights, got into the pool at the Dream Inn, and someone told me that there'd been an eruption of a volcano in Iceland. And the long and short of it was that there were no flights to the Europe from the West Coast for about another 2 weeks.
I remember that.
April 2010. And we were stuck in Santa Cruz, which wasn't the worst thing that's ever happened to us, to be honest. It's raining in London. Everyone's getting less and less sympathetic every day that we kind of saying, I can't get back, sorry, keep running lemon balm, look after it, it'll be fine. And eventually we kind of soon, I set off and started exploring. And we kind of fell in love. We just fell in love with Santa Cruz and the redwoods and the ocean and everything else. And got back to London eventually and kind of thought, it would actually be quite nice to live there, quite nice to bring our son and Nate up there and settle. So we started kind of looking into that and managed to make it happen. It took us about a year and a half.
Right.
But here we are.
So obviously, did you have to close your apothecary in London?
I did. I mean, I'd actually been thinking about the future at that point. I'd started it just before the recession, so it was a tough time to start a business. And I had a 2.5 year, 3 year lease on the building. It was in Camden in North London. And so part of that vacation was to decide whether to renew and take out another 5 year lease. And I think I was probably going to do that. And then this sort of gift from God, if you like, came. And I thought, actually, I don't want to spend the next 5 years sitting in North London. I'd like to spend it somewhere else and kind of take what I've learned from that and move on. So the timing was just perfect, really.
Yeah. I love that word, apothecary, and it conjures up such a lovely image of shelves, sort of wooden shelves with all little pots of different things. And it just has a whole different feel to, like, a pharmacy with all these very clinical drugs, doesn't it? I mean, it's just something warm and inviting about herbs. I'm wondering, or herbs, we should say, for all you Americans out there, when we say herbs, we are referring to herbs. So I think it was Churchill who said that we are two nations separated by a common language.
I'm still learning the language.
So I was wondering, what was your first exposure to herbs? What made you become interested?
You know, I grew up in sort of not exactly rural England, but a smallish town in England, not far from London. And my grandparents had a big garden. They were part of that wartime generation that kind of grew all their own stuff. And so there were a lot of plants in it. And I spent hours, you know, as a child playing in that garden and playing with the plants, you know, making perfume by squishing up rose petals and trying to dye things with marigolds that I found and things like that. So I guess there was always a passion for plants and there was always a kind of interest in being around plants. But it really wasn't until I was a lot older and I'd been working in the corporate world, I worked in marketing, that something spoke to me. And literally one morning I kind of thought, I need to be a herbalist, and kind of looked into it. Didn't realize it was quite as an intense training as it is, you know. It's kind of
right,
3 or 4 year degree, and you know, there's a lot of science, there's a lot of medicine in it effectively. But it just spoke to me, and as soon as I discovered it, I was like, oh, finally, I've worked out what I want to do.
Of course, it's interesting because in the West, we think of herbalism as being this alternative thing, and it's so separated now from allopathic medicine. But, yeah, of course, in the East, it's still the primary way of treating most conditions, isn't it, using herbs?
Totally, in the East and the South. I mean, if you think about Africa, in London, you know, it's very multinational. I had a lot of African patients come in. And, you know, in a lot of parts of Africa, medicine is herbs. And it still is. I mean, there's some statistic, and I don't know how true this is, but something like 70% of the world's population is still using plant-based medicine as their main form of medicine. And if you look at this allopathic Western modern medicine that we have, a lot of the drugs are based on plants. I mean, you know, originally aspirin was synthesized from willow bark. So there's so much that the kind of plant world has to give medicine and has given medicine and keeps on doing it. It's kind of nice the way as well that, in particular in Western herbal medicine, we've incorporated a lot of that kind of Western thinking, a lot of that modern thinking. So, you know, my training is quite sort of how you would learn medicine as a doctor or a nurse or whatever. It's not so much, I mean, I do cover that kind of traditional side as well, but there's an understanding of both, if you like.
Are you meaning in terms of recognizing symptoms as certain diseases and things like that?
Exactly, yeah. Right. I mean, thinking about that paradigm, if you like, of how the body works. So the anatomy and physiology and pharmacology that I learned is exactly the same as you would find in any textbook about how the body works and how the body functions in the world. Whereas if you look at some of the other traditional kind of types of medicine, like Ayurveda in India or traditional Chinese medicine, they have a different... I mean, it's funny how often, actually, it amounts to the same thing, that they have a different way of looking at the body and the way of looking at energy within the body, for example.
Right. Yeah. Now I could see that. So you're getting the best of both, because there is a large degree of preventative approach in herbalism as well, is there?
Massively so, yeah. I mean, I think a huge amount of any kind of being well is staying well. Most of us, thankfully, start out pretty healthy, and then we make choices as we go through our lives about how we maintain that health. And although, of course, you know, bad things happen, but you can really, I believe, kind of control to some degree how your health is as you go through life, and herbs can be a huge part of that, both incorporating them into food and also knowing how to use them so that, you know, if you've got a headache, taking a herb rather than instantly leaping to a headache pill, you're avoiding any possible side effects that you might be getting from those drugs.
And that, to me, seems one of the main benefits of using herbal medicine, is that there really are no side effects.
Certainly fewer side effects, yeah. I mean, they're powerful. Herbs are powerful things. I mean, plants can be very powerful. But certainly if it's used in the right way, and if with a lot of herbs, they're much milder and much more gentle, and they tend to sort of balance themselves out, you know.
I know when you get anything, you know, from the allopathic doctor prescribed, especially in America, it seems even more so, you get this sort of like 4 pages of all the things that you possibly could happen to you. I remember taking something once for an infection, a mild infection, and it said that there was a possibility that I could snap my Achilles tendon by using it. And I was just like, this is bizarre. How could that possibly be related? So I was like, yeah, I don't think I'm going to take that. But it's interesting. A friend of mine who's a herbalist in England is currently working, researching Uva Ursi for urinary tract infections, because the National Health Service in England is very interested in antibiotics being used less because of the resilience to antibiotics. And so far they've found it's very effective. I think it's 85% effective with E. coli. So it just shows you, as you said, the power of herbs.
Absolutely. And I think that you've just touched on something there that's absolutely critical. I've got a kind of a passion when it comes to this question of antibiotic resistance. Antibiotics are the most incredible drugs. I mean, they're amazing and they've saved so many lives. And we're in real danger of losing them if we're not much more careful about when and where we use them. And, you know, if you get a cold, going out into the garden and making some sage tea and taking some echinacea can be just as effective. And you're not kind of breeding, using antibiotics and risking these. The bacteria multiply much more quickly than we do, and they evolve much more quickly than we do. So they're really kind of perfectly designed to become resistant to whatever antibiotics we throw at them. So we've got to be so careful, in my view.
Well, you're listening to It's the Way of Love Live with me, Ruth Copland, and I'm currently talking to our guest, Paula Granger. We're going to go to a commercial break now, but when we come back, we're going to be talking, amongst other things, about the herbs that are local to us that perhaps we could find or grow in our garden that can be used medicinally to support our well-being.
Cabrillo's Stage Professional Musical Theatre will light up your night with their summer repertory season. Opening July 12th is the Broadway sensation La Cage aux Folles. Backed by popular demand on July 25th is Joe Ortiz's musical memoir Escaping Queens. Opening July 26th is the Rodgers and Hammerstein classic Oklahoma. All performing at the Crocker Theatre in Aptos. Charge your tickets by phone at 831-479-6154. That's 479-6154 or at cabrillostage.com.
Susan, my wife Celeste, loves your products.
Thank you.
True Wildlife Connection. And she's the one who will tell me, okay, Charles, you need to go in and get this and this. And I have to have some kind of a program because you have so many different varieties.
Yeah, over 37 extra virgin olive oils, half or single varietals from all over the world. What we bring in is farm-to-table fresh from small producers. Currently, we have 9 organic olive oils, which are fantastic. Last year, we had 6. So we're excited about that. And then we have over 27 aged balsamic vinegars from Modena, Italy. We have a new honey line, a new soap line, a new chocolate line, all kinds of French foods, fun stuff coming in.
By golly, the variety over there is terrific. And also, of course, people are encouraged to do a little tasting.
Yeah, we really encourage everyone to taste everything they want. We're open 7 days a week, 10 to 6 p.m., and we are at 106 Lincoln Street in downtown Santa Cruz, and we're at trueoliveconnection.com. Opa!
Hey, Steph.
Yes, Sean.
I have two things to tell you. One, you look fabulous today.
I look fabulous every day. What else?
Well, Steph, on this week's show, we will be discussing all things youth and chatting with local students as well.
Excellent. Listen to Out in Santa Cruz, Saturdays at 7 p.m. I'm Steph.
And I'm Sean.
And you've been queered.
Hi, you're back with It's the Way of Love Live with me, Ruth Copland, and my guest of this hour, Paula Granger, herbalist and natural health expert. I wanted to ask you, Paula, is there a different perspective on herbal medicine here in the US compared with in the UK?
We've certainly got a different system in the UK. In the UK, herbalists are very sort of recognized, and you can diagnose and you can prescribe, and it's kind of all pretty cool. Here, there's a lot of herbalists. I mean, there's a lot of interest in herbal medicine, especially here on the West Coast and probably especially in Santa Cruz. But the way we practice is slightly different. So, you know, you do a wellness consultation during which you kind of use your knowledge of herbal medicine to help guide someone and suggest the herbs they might use, rather than it being quite as direct as it is in the UK. And also there's probably a greater preponderance of Chinese medicine here, particularly with acupuncture as well. So the herbal side is more tilted towards Chinese herbal medicine, whereas in the UK I'd say it's more towards the Western side of things.
This isn't very scientific because it's just based on my own experience, but I have found that I've responded much better to Western herbs than Chinese herbs. And I was wondering if that's because of, you know, they're indigenous to the area that you're from, which I guess is kind of a macrobiotic principle as well. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I've heard people say that before, and people have said to me, why do I practice Western herbs rather than Chinese? And I guess what I do comes from, you know, particularly Europe, but also there's quite a lot of North American herbs, and we do incorporate kind of Chinese and Indian and other herbs as well. Herbalists are quite omnivorous. If they see a herb that works and that they like, they tend to kind of incorporate it into what they do. But there's certainly an idea that people do respond well to what grows in their local area, and I think there's definitely some truth to that. And I've certainly found that it's good for me. But I've treated people who are Chinese and Indian all different. So I don't know. As you say, there's nothing scientific to suggest that, but it's certainly a way a lot of people feel.
And looking on your website, which if people would like to visit, it's www.paulagranger, and that's paulagranger.com. Remember the I in the Granger.
People always forget it.
paulagranger.com. You can find out more information about Paula's practice and also about her herb walks, which is what I was going to ask you about. I understand you started these in London, and I was going to ask you about that first, because I wondered, where does one go in an urban environment to find herbs?
You know, pretty much anywhere. I mean, most of mine were kind of built around either, there's a lot of parks in London, and there's a wonderful park very near to where I was called Regent's Park. So that was a really good kind of hunting ground. And there's a canal which runs through the Regent's Park, which has a lot of plants growing on it. But very often, you know, it would take me half an hour, 40 minutes to get from my shop, clinic, apothecary, to the park, which was only 5 minutes walk away. Because if you walk along the street, you will see little plants, same here, little plants kind of growing up between the cracks in the sidewalk. There'll be trees, there'll be landscaping that people have put in, there'll be people's gardens. There are plants absolutely everywhere, and that for me was one of the great pleasures about doing those urban herb walks, was just finding what grows, how opportunistic plants are, and how they'll just sort of pop up. And I think it's one of the great pleasures of taking people on herb walks, because it invigorates and enlivens every walk, every hike, every, you know, walk down to your school or whatever it is, if you know what plants you're seeing and how they're used and what they do and what the history and their folklore is.
So is that what you cover on your herb walks? You would be giving some of that to people who are with you?
All of that, as much as I can, yeah. I've got a real passion and interest in the kind of folkloric history of plant use. So there's always stories and tales of how plants were used a long time ago, or how they were seen, or how they were described to other people using these stories. And then, of course, there is this very modern, very chemical-based kind of use of them as well that I can talk about. And just getting people to know and recognize the plants, you know, helping them tell the difference, helping them see why one plant is different from another.
Yeah, I know when I was growing up, we learned all about the different trees at school, and I've forgotten it now, but it was so interesting when you're out and you know, oh, that's a horse chestnut and that's an oak, and it does make all the difference. And I think, I was just thinking that in this digital age, we're becoming less and less connected, or it's easy to become less connected, yeah, with the natural environment. And the more knowledge that you have, it's going to draw you into that more, I'm guessing, even as you're saying, in an urban environment where you perhaps wouldn't expect to be looking, yeah, for plants.
Absolutely, and it's particularly important in an urban environment, because I think people have a desire to, they have an interest in plants, they have a desire to connect with plants, and this kind of feeds that. And particularly for children, I mean, I love trying to teach children the Latin names of plants, because, and people say, well, how can they learn that? And yet any child who's a big fan of, I don't know, Mutant Ninja Turtles or whatever, Pokemon, whatever it is, will know every single name of every single character. And, you know, they've
even
got
though they're quite strange.
Yeah, and they'll have this incredible capacity to kind of learn. So, you know, there's no reason why a child can't learn the name of a plant and what it does. And, you know, my son's name, he's getting really quite good. He can kind of spot different plants as we go out walking and what they do. And that, I just think that's a wonderful thing for children to grow up with, that connection with the natural world.
When I was little, our big thing was dock leaves for nettles. There's a lot of nettles in England. And when you, our childhood was more about roaming around than being on a device. And so you would come a cropper quite often with nettles.
Absolutely.
And then it was the search for the dock leaves, which then you would spit on and crush up and rub on your leg or whatever.
And that's such, I mean, that's the one thing in England. Everyone knows that. And here, no one seems to know it. Everyone I've spoken to, even if they don't grow up in California, if they've grown up somewhere where there are nettles, don't seem to know about it. So spread the word. We've got to tell everybody.
I assume they didn't have dock leaves here. But
no, yeah, they do. Yeah, absolutely, they do. Yeah. Wander up Poconet, there's loads of them up there.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's very good.
But there's not
know.
Many stinging nettles, so I think that's probably the thing. It's the lack of nettles.
Right. Speaking of nettles, now nettle tea is quite good, isn't it, for some things?
It's very good for lots of things, actually. It's very high in iron. If you ever see nettles growing, you'll notice that there's not a lot else growing around them. And it's because they're really greedy. They kind of steal all the minerals from the soil. So they really suck them up. So they're very high in minerals, and particularly iron. If you ever taste nettle tea, it's got that kind of slightly kind of minerally, metallic-y kind of taste to it. So they're good for people, anyone who needs extra iron, great for people who are pregnant or breastfeeding or whatever. Very, very safe. But they're also a really good antihistamine as well. I use them a lot to treat people, to treat nettle rash, interestingly. You can take them. So if people are getting seasonal allergies, whether it's causing sneezing and runny nose and all that, or whether it's causing kind of a rash.
So hay fever.
Hay fever, exactly.
Now, I know you can buy nettle tea from the health shop, but you could also just pick nettles yourself. And how would one go about making a tea of that?
Carefully, they sting. So gloves, either gloves, or there's actually a thing you can do where you kind of grasp the nettle really hard, and the stingy bit is in little kind of silica hairs on the back of the leaf. And if you grip them hard enough, they break. But I've done that on so many herb walks, showing off and got it wrong and kind of walked around, clutching my hand, trying not to wince for the rest of the walk, looking for a dock leaf. But basically you can just chop them up, pour boiling water on them. And this is true of pretty much any herb as well. And then leave them to sit for 5 or 10 minutes. It's good to leave it for a little bit longer. A lot of people don't do it for long enough. So 5 or 10 minutes, and then just strain it off and drink it out. And you can eat nettles as well. Nettles make a wonderful soup. When you cook them like spinach, just sort of with a little water and kind of steam them down. And when you do that, those little hairs, again, disintegrate and it doesn't sting.
That's good to know, because yeah. That would not be good in your mouth, having that.
Don't eat them raw. That's a very strong hint.
So is that wildcrafting, what you just described?
That is exactly wildcrafting, yeah. I mean, wildcrafting is obviously cultivating is either growing or picking from someone else who's growing for you. But wildcrafting is going out into the wild and picking plants. And there's obviously a great deal of responsibility around that in terms of not taking things which are endangered, not taking too much of things. But things like, you know, nettles, dandelions, I've never heard anyone complain about someone kind of taking a few nettles and dandelions. Although officially, I should say, you're not allowed to pick anything in state parks.
Okay.
Not so much as a daisy head.
Good to know. Dandelions. I know in England there's like dandelion tea and dandelion coffee in inverted commas.
Absolutely.
I think it's good for helping you sleep, isn't it?
Actually, no. It's good for the liver. So particularly the dandelion root, which is what's often made into the coffee, is a really good liver herb. Kind of gentle, but gently kind of... Anything bitter stimulates your liver. Because when you get that bitter taste in your mouth, it starts to stimulate the juices all the way down through your digestive system. And eventually that gets to the liver and helps to stimulate the release of bile. So it just has a really nice sort of, if you've been kind of not so nice to your liver of late, kind of too much coffee or too much alcohol or whatever, then some dandelion root tea is a really nice, gentle kind of liver tonic.
So is that a good hangover?
It is, although the best remedy? One and the best known one for hangovers is milk thistle. People always ask me this. It's funny.
I don't know why I don't drink so, but I just was thinking with the liver, I was like, oh, maybe.
People always want to know that, yeah. No, milk thistle seeds are really good for that. And milk thistle grows. I mean, I write about different herbs that I come across in Santa Cruz on my blog, and which is on my website, and... I was so excited when I got here and found all the milk thistle everywhere. It's everywhere.
Wow.
But the seeds are really hard to harvest because it's prickly and they're hard little things. So, in fact, to be honest, I go and buy them from the herb room.
Right.
they're dead cheap and they're much easier to get from
there. And that's on Mission Street.
On Mission Street,
right?
Yeah. I think it's Mission and Laurel.
Right.
Yeah. They're really good.
Now, there's different forms of herbal medicine. Tinctures is the liquid.
Yeah.
That's sort of an extraction of the whole plant, usually, is it?
Yeah, tincture is made, and we teach some medicine-making courses. I do them with a herbalist here called Darren Huckle sometimes, and they're really fun. He makes a lot of his own tincture, and I'm increasingly making my own as well. So tincture is an alcoholic extract of the herb. So essentially, you get your herb, and it might be, you know, leaf, flower, root, seed, whatever it is, chop it up fine, pour on alcohol, and you can kind of use a stronger alcohol. I tend to use vodka. So it covers it, and then just sit it for a period of time, kind of anywhere between about 2 weeks to 4 weeks usually. And then you strain it off carefully, make sure there's nothing in there. And that's, it preserves well. And it's that's another difference actually between English and herbalism and herbal medicine here, where a lot of people use tincture in the UK, and it's how we're trained for the most part, and we use other things too, but it's really easy to blend, and you can be really controlled about it, so you can know exactly how much is going in of each herb.
So I would say probably for if you're going for, if you're wanting to use herbs for a specific ailment, then it'd be quite a good idea to go to somebody like you who's more knowledgeable in how to treat that.
Well, I would say it, but yes, it is. It's important. It's particularly important, I think, if you're wanting to take herbs for medicinal purposes, that you talk to a professional, that if you're on any medication, you talk to your doctor. If you're pregnant or you've got a severe illness, then you really should consult a professional before you consider doing it. But there are some things that I would say are pretty much safe for everybody. And certainly there's some herbs that grow here wonderfully and that, you know, are very safe to use for anybody, really.
Well, that's good to know. How long, out of interest, do you think using herbs medicinally have been part of human culture? time immemorial?
Really time immemorial. In fact, since before we were humans, I think. There was a fascinating, someone dug up a Neanderthal grave in Europe, in France, I think it was, and they found that there were 6 medicinal herbs that are still used medicinally now, which have been laid around the body in such a way that implied that, you know, they've been put there by on purpose. They hadn't just happened to fall into the grave. So, and in fact, animals are known to do it. I mean, anyone who's got a cat knows that they'll occasionally eat some grass. And bears are famous for their kind of using plants. I think humans have done it since the very, very earliest times. And what I don't know is whether they were doing it instinctively or whether it was knowledge that was passed down originally.
Right.
Probably a bit of both, I suspect.
It seems that indigenous cultures have really maintained their connection with herbs. I mean, maybe because they have maintained their connection with the land.
Yeah.
And synergistically living with the land rather than, I don't know, the Western model has been more dominating the land, hasn't it?
I think it has, and I think there's a lot of those kind of native traditions that, I mean, also to be fair, because they've not always had access to other types of medicine, but yeah, there's definitely been a maintenance, and I think this knowledge and this craft, and I think it is a craft to a large degree, is very highly valued in a lot of those cultures. So this information isn't thrown around, it's passed on with great care and love and attention to the next generation, as a kind of part of the cultural heritage and part of the cultural capital, if you like, of that indigenous culture, of all those indigenous cultures.
Well, you're listening to It's the Way of Love Live on KSCO AM 1080 with me, Ruth Copland, and my current guest in the studio, Paula Granger. I wanted to let you know that in the second hour, we're going to be talking to Anne-Marie Sayers from Indian Canyon, and she's going to be telling us about an upcoming event there, an Indian storytelling event. And then towards the end of the second hour, we're also going to be talking to Deborah Allen, who's a producer and screenplay writer of a film called Jane. And there's a fundraiser for that coming up locally, too, and it's an amazing film. Very important film, so we'll be telling you more about that later. Right now, we're going to go to some more messages, and we're going to play out with some more Beatles on our English-themed first hour. Keep it here on KSCO AM 1080.
She was a working girl, north of England way. And if she could only hear me, this is what I'd say. Honey pie, you are making me crazy. I'm in love, but I'm lazy. So won't you please come home?
Prop's Restaurant and Flight Line Lounge. They were new a year ago. They're still new, but they're better than ever. The menu's been expanded. They still have a great full bar. They're offering specials now 5 nights a week instead of just 1. And also, watch the planes come in for landings and takeoffs and enjoy a great salad, appetizer, drink, and a full menu of 10 specialty sandwiches, about a dozen specialty burgers, wonderful specials. Let me give you an example. Their Wednesday night prime rib special, a great 14-ounce cut of prime rib with a baked potato and green beans is only $16. Try beating that. Monday night's Specials barbecue ribs. Thursday is surf and turf, prawns and steak, only $16. Props Restaurant and Flightline Lounge. Open every single day for lunch and dinner. Take the Airport Boulevard exit off of Highway 1, half a mile down the road to Aviation Way, to your left, and there you are at Props Restaurant and Flightline Lounge. Go, eat, drink, and enjoy. Go on Facebook, look at Props, and make your entry for their new slogan. You might win the first sweatshirt that comes off the line with your slogan on it.
Why does the United States spend the largest percentage of GDP in the world on health care? Why do we have the highest cancer rates on the planet, the highest rates of diabetes, autism, and every other major disease? It all comes down to one thing. We are what we eat. Our food is devoid of nutrition and processed with poisons and additives. Our water is filled with toxic poisons and big pharma runoff. We can turn the tide against those who seek to profit by making and keeping us unhealthy by giving ourselves the nutrients our bodies desperately need. To learn more, go to kscohealth.com. The site is literally packed with audio and video featuring top health professionals who don't bow down to big pharma. The fight against servitude starts with you, and you can't stand against the machine if you are sick, tired, and obese. When you visit kscohealth.com, be sure to check out the catalog with nearly 400 life-changing products and get free shipping when you sign up for auto ship.
My position is tragic. Come and show me the magic of your Hollywood song.
Well, we're here listening to the magic of Paula Granger. I'm learning lots of stuff about herbal medicine, and we're going to move on now, I think, to looking at local plants. For people that are listening, what you can see around you and maybe be able to use, and also maybe what you can grow, because even if you don't have a garden or you live in a more urban area, you can always grow things to use for your well-being, right?
Yeah, totally. If you've got a window box or a front porch that's got a little space for a pot, you can grow some things. And there's stuff just sort of growing around as well if you kind of go to your local park or whatever. As long as you make sure they're not using chemicals or whatever, then yeah, you can, and neighbours are always very nice. You know, if you offer to do a bit of free weeding, they'll kind of not object for the most part.
We have a great system in England called an allotment system, where if you don't have your own land, you can actually apply from the local council and be given, you go on a waiting list, and then you actually get your own plot. I don't think there's anything like that here, but no. Except for the Homeless Garden Project, which enables, I think that's an amazing project to let people who are homeless be able to grow things. But
it's amazing.
That's a good idea too. You just sort of ask your neighbour, can I have just a little tidy place?
Yeah. And also go to places like the Homeless Garden Project. I was down there yesterday afternoon actually picking up a friend's CSA, and they've got a ton of stuff growing. They've got loads of marigolds, they've got loads of oregano, and they've got stuff that they're not actually deliberately growing. It's just growing there because it's an organic space.
Oh.
And because it's California and everything grows like crazy. And I'm sure if you spotted, I'm going to be in trouble with the Homeless Garden Project now, because everyone will be descending and trying to pick stuff. But, you know, if you ask places like that, they'll very often let you take a handful of this or a bunch of that.
Well, they sell stuff too, don't they?
So they do,
if you go down there, you know, make sure you purchase something too, support that project, because I think it's a wonderful...
Absolutely. And you can purchase all kinds of herbs, you know, from there, and from, you know, the farmer's market has a really good selection of herbs. I've seen stinging nettles at the farmer's market here. And there's certainly things like rosemary and sage and thyme and all these wonderful kind of culinary herbs that have a medicinal use too.
So what would be their uses? Because obviously we're very familiar with stuffing for turkey and things like those, but
exactly.
And most people, that's what they're familiar with, is culinary uses. So
yeah.
What would one use rosemary for instance?
Rosemary is a really stimulant herb. I mean, if you smell it, you can smell how stimulant it is. So it's got a kind of uplifting quality to it. It's very good for headaches. Make a rosemary tea for headaches. It's also, a lot of these really aromatic herbs have a lot of essential, well, all of them have a lot of essential oil in, and those essential oils are quite antimicrobial. So, for example, rather than using that dreadful antibacterial hand wash that everybody uses, you could make some rosemary tea and use that as a kind of spray on surfaces and all that kind of thing. And just using it if you're going down with, you know, a throat infection or something like that, gargling with it, using it to bathe a cut, or anywhere that you would use kind of an antibacterial type thing.
Talking of essential oils, I understand from a friend of mine who's a naturopathic doctor that lavender oil, like vats of lavender oil, was used in the First World War for people with really bad burns.
Yeah, and you know, it, as a general rule, you mustn't put undiluted essential oil onto your skin. But the one exception is lavender oil, and the biggest application for it is burns. And I've seen remarkable results with that. In fact, my husband burned himself the other week and on the oven, on the cooker, and you just, a few drops of it, neat. So you put it under cold water, take the heat out of it for a while, dry it off and put some neat, some undiluted lavender oil on. And it's remarkable. It stops stinging and you don't get the scarring or the blistering.
Yeah. Interesting. As you mentioned, your husband, we might just talk about very briefly that he is the very well-known best-selling novelist Michael Marshall. He's very lucky to be married to you.
Too kind.
So he moved here, obviously, but he could write anywhere, so it didn't affect him.
Absolutely. I mean, that was one of the... his books are actually set in the US, and he was busy writing books based in America from England, from London. So it's actually quite nice for him. And he'd always been interested in the idea of living in the US. So, and it was partly that realization that he can write anywhere, you know. So... why not write here rather than there, kind of thing. So,
and what's his view on herbal medicine and approaching your health in that way?
He's a really big supporter, actually. I mean, he really, he's been so supportive and so kind of behind me all the way. And, I mean, he was telling someone recently, I don't think he's seen a doctor for 10 years or something like that. And, you know, I treat him. He always complains that I tend to sort of, you know, he'll have a sore throat or something and I'll kind of not get round to treating him. It's that thing of, you know, the family you don't always remember to treat. So, yeah, he's a big fan.
Oh, that's good. So let's go back to the conversation we were having before. What would thyme be useful for?
Thyme is brilliant for coughs. It's quite expectorant, so it helps you to kind of bring up muck on your lungs, as it were. I quite often make a syrup using thyme and licorice together. Just boiling up the two of them in a pan with some water and then straining it off and adding some honey. And children like it. It's quite delicious. And it's a really good kind of soothing expectorant for the kind of lingering, nasty cough that you get after a cold or flu.
Well, I see we've got a caller on the line, Terry in Aptos. So we're going to go to him now. Hello, Terry.
Hey, how you doing there?
I'm doing very well. How are you, Terry?
Well, I was driving down a road, and I was listening to your discussion about nettles and got all excited about it, and then I realized my cell phone didn't work in that neck of the woods, so I drove home and picked up the phone and thought I'd ask a question or two.
Oh, well, thank you for going to all that effort. Fire away. Hi, Terry.
Hi. We have an abundant crop each spring of burning nettles.
Uh-huh.
And they're similar to the stinging nettles, but they grow slow and they're more mint-like. You know, the leaves are actually quite attractive. And if it weren't such a noxious weed, that, you know, we'd really love it. But
yeah.
Can you do the same things with the burning nettles that you can, the stinging nettles, as far as the teas and the, you know, the stews and, you know, the different kinds of salads and various things?
I've not come across the burning nettle. One of the things that it's always interesting is common names for things. Things will get different names in different places.
Correct.
Is it like a regular stinging nettle?
Well, a stinging nettle is kind of rangy and tall and spread out, and the burning nettle is more compact and more ground hugging.
Mm-hmm.
And the sad thing is that you sit there figuring you've got plenty of time before you can pull it out and get rid of it.
Yeah.
But the seed, the flowering part of the seed, actually grows on the shaft between the leaves. So even though it's growing up and you expect it to have a terminal flower where it'll spread the seeds, in the meantime, it's been seeding like crazy and you didn't know it.
Sneaky.
And, yeah, very sneaky. So you dig the whole thing out, you dig it out, roots and all, everything is really great. Bag it up and take it to the landfill, whatever. And the next spring, you've got just as much as you had before.
There it comes. Does it sting like a stinging nettle?
Oh, yeah.
And it's those little flowers are kind of like little stringy things that stick out, yeah?
Well, you can't really see the flowers very much.
Yeah.
They're, they're almost non-existent. They're just little teeny things. But if you're not careful when you're taking out, like if you're using gloves and you get a little bit on your wrist or something above the glove, you know it right away.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem the animals like it. We have a couple of sheep, and they won't eat them.
They don't. Donkeys, I think, are about the only thing that will eat nettles.
Donkeys?
Apparently,
okay.
So. So maybe you need to get some donkeys.
There you go. I just like a little flock of donkeys.
Happy donkeys in Aptos. We'll borrow some just in the springtime.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, I've been trying to. Some people say their goats will eat them, but most people say goats won't eat them.
Yeah,
buy a goat and find out it doesn't. No.
Well, borrow a goat, maybe.
You mentioned the milky thistles or whatever they're called.
Milk thistle, yeah.
Milk thistle. I'm not sure that's the same kind we have or not, but it has a purple bloom.
Yep.
And it's quite tall. Is that the one?
The thing about milk thistle that's very distinctive is it's got these big kind of green leaves, but it looks as though someone drizzled white paint all over it.
I know.
Like a lacy pattern of white on it.
Well, I know when you cut these open or you break them off, there's a milky sap that comes out.
Yeah. A lot of thistles will have that, but the milk thistle specifically has this kind of traced white line on the leaves. As though someone's drizzled milk on it.
So the sheep won't eat those either.
No, they're very spiky.
And they just seed like crazy.
Yeah, they do. So
they're not like the star thistles. Those will puncture a tire. No, they're terrible. Those little yellow flowering ones.
Yeah.
So are thistles good for anything? Not milk thistle, but the other kind that
the
Mary
other kind,
has?
They're not generally used medicinally. Most of there's blessed thistle, which is used. But artichoke, of course, is a thistle.
Sure.
And it's a hugely popular one here because so much of it grows. And we use the leaf of that to treat cholesterol, actually. I use...
cholesterol?
Yeah, to treat high cholesterol. So artichoke leaves, more tinctured, they don't taste very good as a tea. They're very bitter. They're again, a really good liver herb, and that's sort of how they affect the cholesterol is by improving the liver clearance.
So what do you think about Terry's nettles? Would you need to see them
to
be sure?
I would have to see them. I'm sorry to be boring. Yeah. By the sound of it, I'm 90% sure that it's a kind of stinging nettle and that it would be safe to use. But I'm always super cautious. I don't want people taking something that might damage them. So, if you look on my website, next spring, contact me, and I'll come down to Aptos and have a look, and I'll tell you.
Oh, what is that site? I didn't hear that.
So it's www.paulagranger.com, and that's Paula Granger is spelled PaulaGranger. So PaulaGranger.com.
Okay, well, I'm going to look it up right now and save it, and then you'll be hearing from me.
Great. I'll look forward to meeting you.
Well, thanks very much for calling in,
Thank
Terry.
Thank you very much. Uh-huh.
All right. Good day. Bye.
Bye.
Cool. Well, that would be good if he could start using them, wouldn't it? I mean, that's the thing when you have something that's a pest and then you can make it into something really useful.
It's brilliant.
It feels good.
It's one of the nice things about being a herbalist as a gardener is that you've got a great excuse not to do the weeding. You're saying, no, I'm growing loads of medicinal plants in there. That's deliberate.
I like that. I think a lot of people might be very keen to employ that approach.
The best excuse.
So we talked about thyme, rosemary thyme. Sage was the other. Now, that's a big Native American herb used for ceremonies and things. I'm quite familiar with that in California, but medicinally?
Especially the white sage here. I mean, it's beautiful. I love it. Sage is one of those that we just talked about the different kinds of nettles. And with sage, there's a number of different kinds. I mean, many, many different kinds of sage. So I was sort of trained on the European one. But the white sage and the black sage, both of which grow so well here, can be used interchangeably with European sage. It's the best thing for sore throats. If you are going down with a sore throat, get yourself a good old handful of sage, and you can dry it, but it grows so well here and all year round here. Pour some boiling water on it, fresh or dried. Let it steep for 10 minutes. Strain it out. Add some honey, which, again, there's a lot of great local honeys here. And that's very antimicrobial in its own right, as well as soothing, and then gargle and swallow it. It's a really nice herb. Another use of it as well is for ladies of a certain age who find themselves getting warmer than they would like to stick at night. Drinking a cold sage tea, it's got to be cold, but making a good strong sage tree and drinking it cold is a real good kind of fix for that.
for sort of hot flashes,
hot flashes,
with menopause. Or,
exactly. Yeah, precisely.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, we're coming up to the end of the first hour, but I'd like to just cover, there was a few other herbs that you thought that were local that might be of interest to people. Did you want to talk about them?
Hundreds, I could sit here all night, but I'll...
I'll choose two.
Okay, my top two. All right, so fennel seed. Fennel grows everywhere here, and traditionally the fennel, the sweet fennel is used, but the wild fennel here works too. So fennel seeds... use them, just nibble on them or use them as a tea after eating. And if you tend to suffer from gassiness and sort of unpleasant bloating sensations, it's tremendous for that. And my other one would be plantain. Now, I'm not talking about the big yellow, big green bananas. I'm talking about the little European plant that is not, like me, it's kind of import here. Grows absolutely everywhere in grass. I'm going to put a picture of it. I don't think there's one on the website, but I'm going to put one on the website so people can identify it. If you like hiking or being outdoors, which it would appear everybody here does, then it's a great one to know, because if you get bites or stings, mosquito bites, wasps, bees, you name it, just squish some of this up until the juice runs, and then apply it to the sting or the bite, and it will really help. It'll soothe it and take away the pain.
Great. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in, Paula. And if you're listening and you would like to have a consultation with Paula, or you'd like to learn about her herb walks that she's doing in Santa Cruz to learn more about the plants around you and their history and how you can use them to optimize your well-being, then do go to her site that she was telling Terry about. It's www.paulagrainger.com. So that's PaulaGrainger.com. And it's a great site. She has an excellent blog that's very interesting. And you got lots of nice photos. And you'd never know that you transplanted from England, because you've got all the Californian stuff up. And
it's great.
It's a good site. So, yeah, if you're interested in generally finding out more about herbs, or perhaps something specifically for an ailment, or just to boost your general well-being, then Paula's your girl, I'm going to say. Thanks so much again for coming in.
Thank you.
Lovely having you. And I wanted to let listeners know that after the news, which is coming up at 6, we're going to be talking to Anne-Marie Sayers, who's one of the caretakers of Indian Canyon. Now, Indian Canyon is the only land continuously held by the Ohlone people, who were the first inhabitants of the San Francisco and Monterey Bay areas. So we're very happy to be talking to her, and also about an upcoming Indian Canyon storytelling event. And then we're also going to be talking to Deborah Allen about a fundraising event for her film Jane. So keep it here on KSCO AM 1080. I'm Ruth Copland. You're listening to It's the Way of Love Live.
Pull the screen.
Source for news, sports, traffic, and weather. AM 1080, KSCO, Santa Cruz, San Jose, Salinas, and Monterey.
CBS News, I'm Sam Litzinger. It was an ordinary landing that turned into anything but. An Asiana airplane with more than 300 people on board was coming into San Francisco International Airport when something went wrong. The plane crashed and burned. Officials say at least two people were killed, dozens hurt. One person is still unaccounted for. This man was at the airport when the crash happened.
We're sitting there at the gate just waiting, and then the plane was coming in, and the tail end was just too low, and it clipped and hit the runway, like, really hard.
The tail of the plane came off. The aircraft left a trail of debris before coming to rest beside the runway. National Transportation Safety Board Chairman Deborah Herzman is heading to the crash scene.
We're certainly going to be looking at the aircraft to try to find the cockpit voice recorders and flight data recorders are functioning at the time of the accident. We'll be looking to get information from them as well as document the accident scene.
President Obama is sending his thanks to the first responders and promising to keep his team in the loop as the investigation moves ahead. A train derailment about 150 miles east of Montreal has forced the evacuation of hundreds of people, and at least one death is reported. The crash sparked a fire that spread to some homes. CJAD radio reporter Lee Shuyi.
The numbers could possibly go up. They say that they are getting many calls about missing loved ones. They won't confirm how many calls they've been getting, just many calls. And many people are still looking for friends and family, so that number could go up.
Police say several people have been reported missing. Venezuela's president says he's offering asylum to admitted NSA leaker Edward Snowden, joining Nicaragua and Bolivia. Snowden's believed to still be at the Moscow airport, and Chris Sabatini with the America Society says getting him out of there will be tricky.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I think the key here is going to be the practicality of it, because it's one thing to say you can do it, but how you will practically do it, it could well be an impossibility.
The United States has canceled Snowden's passport, which means technically he's stuck. Government money is tight these days, and CBS News correspondent Pam Coulter says that means fighting wildfires in the West is probably going to be even harder.
The Southwest has suffered through drought for several years, leaving conditions ripe for the kinds of fires that killed 19 firefighters in Arizona. Senator John McCain said there's already a shortage of air tankers, and the federal sequester will further hamper firefighting efforts.
We are facing cuts that will reduce the capability of the Forest Service to combat these fires.
The automatic budget cuts also mean the Defense Department's civilian workers will take the first of 11 furlough days next week. Pam Coulter, CBS News, Washington.
The New England Patriots are letting fans trade in their number 81 Aaron Hernandez jerseys for different ones this weekend. The former Patriots tight end has been charged with the murder in the death of a 27-year-old semi-pro football player, Odin Lloyd. He's pleaded not guilty. This is CBS News.
Here's a surprising summertime fact from new Allegra Anti-Itch Cream. We all know that irritants like bug bites and poison ivy can make you itch. But what you might not know is how. Actually, it's the histamines your body creates in reaction to these irritants that make you miserable. But now that scratch has met its match. New Allegra Anti-Itch Cream. Its maximum strength itch medicine blocks your itch-causing histamines fast for long-lasting relief. New Allegra Anti-Itch Cream. The relief you've been itching for. Use as directed.
Hey, Chris, late for swim practice, no?
I decided it wasn't really my thing.
But you liked swimming, and with your grades down last semester, at least it could help with college. Oh, some kid, Frank, came by. I knocked on your door, but you didn't answer. Hey, where are your new sneakers?
Oh, I forgot them at school.
Well, you seem to be forgetting a lot lately.
The signs are there. So is our help. For advice on coping with teen drug use, visit the partnership at drugfree.org.
A royal baby's on the way, and some British bookies are already making a profit.
The next heir to the British throne is expected to be born in 7 days, and the bookmakers are taking millions on nearly everything about the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge's royal bundle of joy. Most people bet it'll be a girl, and if it is, the two top names are Alexandra and Charlotte, with the name of William's late mother Diana a close third. For a boy, the bets are on James and George. One bookie reports two long shot bets on Mohammed. Bets are also being taken on the baby's hair color. 4-1 odds it'll be a redhead. Larry Miller, CBS News, London.
Wyoming park ranger Nick Patrick was attacked and severely hurt by a grizzly bear, but he's pretty forgiving about the whole thing. He says the 400-pound bear was just trying to protect her cubs when she attacked, and she could have killed him any time, but didn't. Patrick is facing several surgeries. Sam Litzinger, CBS News.
Good evening, Central Coast. You're listening to KSEO AM 1080 Santa Cruz and KOMY 1340 Watsonville. It's 6:05, and I'm Sam Quinton with your King of the Hill traffic and weather.
We will start off in the San Jose area. Highway 85 northbound at the De Anza Boulevard on-ramp. We have report of a large metal object in the number 2 lane there. And CHP has been assigned to the scene. On Highway 17 southbound and Lexington Reservoir, we have an animal hazard reported there. Two goats on the side of the road. Look out for the two goats. I'm sure someone is on the way to collect them. And let's see, what else do we have? Right now, we have traffic has eased up on Highway 17 northbound a little bit. It's going a little bit better for you. You'll find a little slowdown on southbound Highway 1, right around 41st Boulevard. Other than that, everything is looking fairly well, except, we have brand new one here on the board. Santa Cruz area at the address 4911 Graham Hill Road. We have a report of a hit and run and further details, but no injuries are being reported, and CHP has been assigned. Your KSCO Central Coast weather tonight, partly cloudy. Partly to mostly cloudy this evening. Patchy fog after midnight. Lows in the lower 50s and southwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour in the evening, then becoming light. Tomorrow, cloudy in the morning, then becoming sunny. Patchy fog in the morning. Highs in the lower 70s and light winds becoming southwest 5 to 15 miles per hour in the afternoon. Your boaters forecast for the Monterey Bay tonight. West winds 10 knots in the evening, then becoming light. Wind waves less than 2 feet, and a western swell of 2 to 4 feet at 10 seconds with some patchy fog after midnight. Currently at 75 degrees in San Jose, 76 in Boulder Creek, 64 in Watsonville, 65 in Salinas, and 61 degrees in Monterey. Right now outside the KSCO studios, it is 64 degrees. And now we'll return for the second hour of It's the Way of Love Live.
Hi, you're listening to It's the Way of Love Live with me, Ruth Copland, on KSCO AM 1080. Thank you so much again to Paula Granger for coming in. It was very interesting hearing about how the things that are just growing around us, even things such as weeds like nettles that Terry from Aptos is having a problem with, can be used to help us. And I think it's a tremendously empowering thing to know that you can actually help yourself by just using things from the natural environment. So in the second hour, going to be moving on to talking to Anne Marie Sayers, who is one of the caretakers of Indian Canyon. And Indian Canyon is the only land continuously held by the Ohlone people, the first inhabitants of the San Francisco and Monterey Bay areas. And Indian Canyon is the only federally recognized Indian country along coastal Northern California from Santa Barbara to Sonoma. So it's a pretty special place. And we're very happy to have Anne-Marie with us today. And Anne-Marie, are you there?
I'm right here, yes.
Thank you so much for calling in. I understand that you have a ceremony going on there today, so we're very grateful for you taking the time out.
And it's an amazing ceremony. It's the ghost dance. And it's the first time that ghost dance has ever come to here to Indian Canyon, and it's led by Shoshone gentlemen, the integrity and purity of this healing dance. It's a dance for all people, and it's incredibly beautiful.
Now, the ghost dance is quite well known in as much that it's been in various films, but could you tell us a bit more about what it actually is bringing about?
You're dancing, you express your intent for dancing, why it is that you are dancing, and usually it's for healing. It's for healing our mother. It's for healing family members. It's for healing negative aspects that come into people's lives. It is a healing, and it also brings you clarity. And it is amazingly, incredibly spiritual, along with being very invigorating. It's absolutely beautiful. It's a reason, for me, it's a reason for living.
Wow.
To honor our ancestors.
I think that one of the amazing things about Native cultures is that they do embody these kind of ceremonies that address such important psychological and emotional aspects of our lives that pretty much have, you know, get lost a lot in Western culture.
I think the Western culture is coming to the realization that the right brain must be active. We have to reactivate the right part of one's brain for the creativity and to truly hold all life in a sacred manner.
I mean, one of the things that I think people are familiar with Native American ideology is this idea of the kind of web, that we are all connected by this web, and whatever we do to another person or within our environment is affecting everything around us.
All life. That is accurate. We are all related. And with that realization, you become a part of. An example, in our language, the Mutsu language, Rama. Rama is water, but it's not just H2O. It's actual water. It's the sound of the water. It is the movement of the water. It's the creek or the riverbanks that hold the water. They are one and inseparable. And there's no word in the English language that describes, that has that definition. It is, we are all connected. We are all interconnected, and we are all related. Yes.
I was, when I was doing research to talk to you, I was reading the article from the Californian that, I think, did your daughter write that article? Or was it you?
I'm not sure which article you're referring to.
Probably doesn't matter that much. Oh, it's as a presentation by... Anyway, it doesn't really matter, but it's on your website. I wanted to send people to your website. It's IndianCanyonLife.org. It's very interesting about the history and about the caretakers, but it also has this article. It's pretty long. It's your... I think it's in your own words about how you came to have Indian Canyon be held by you in perpetuity now. And one of the things that I was interested in is that this missionary who came, his view, his perspective of the ceremonies of the native peoples was, just one of just not understanding at all, what was behind them, that this connection with the energy of life of not only other people, but the grass and the water and everything that is around us. And seeing that as a very simplistic thing instead of what it really is, which is fundamental to all of our beings.
No, until you have viewed something through a different lens, it's very difficult. And I believe the majority of Europeans, when they first came here, it was so foreign to them that they just did not understand. But slowly, I am finding there are more people and more people that realize they need a different lens to view through, and they are doing so. Particularly among, we have literally thousands of college students that come up, primarily those who are taking Native American study classes. And when they'll stop at the Mission of San Juan Bautista and see that the Native perspective is almost invisible outside of the cemetery, and then they come up to Indian Canyon, and it's like night and day, even today. But it is getting better. And the diversity here in California has helped tremendously because of the fact that you get not just a European perspective, but also the Asian perspective and also the Hispanic perspective, also or the Latino perspective. And with the openness of the youth, they find how it is that they are included, particularly when they come to the canyon, because it's all the life. Let it be the sycamore trees, the coastal live oak, or the elderberry trees, the bays trees. You literally can feel the ancestral spirit still here. And that welcoming, it does allow you to feel what it truly is to be included, to be a part of. And with that introduction, it allows you to be open and see what was not seen before.
I think that's so true. If we take that time to just stop and allow ourselves to be and listen to our own hearts, but also to nature around us, I think the insights that are possible to gain can be astounding.
There's no doubt about that. You know, there are a lot of people that have NDD and totally unaware of it. And it's a legitimate mental disorder, and it's nature deficit disorder. You're unaware of it until you become exposed to nature and all the beauty that it has. That's just natural.
I was just going to say, I think, you know, it's got to a point where urban children are not just not connected to nature, but they also don't see a connection between their food and understanding where it comes from, let alone having any deeper kind of spiritual connection with nature.
Until they're exposed to it. And when they are, it's amazing how, particularly when you're young, you know you are a part of. But as far as food is concerned, you're quite right. The majority of people believe that they'll get their food from downtown Safeway.
Yeah, without any thought of the life energy that went into it and the giving of the earth to give us that bounty. Well, I think that's why what you're doing is so amazing with Indian Canyon, because it does provide a place for people who need land ceremony. I understand you have various gatherings there where people can come and connect in a deeper way.
We've opened up my great-grandfather's trust allotment to all Indigenous people whom are in need of traditional land for ceremony. And my mother believed when ceremony stops, so does the earth. And I too believe that our society is primarily absent of the sacred. And when you connect with our mother, with the earth, you truly understand what sacredness is. And you have a complete, totally different perspective. And I encourage that very, very much. The American Indian in this country did not get the right to practice their religion freely until 1978 or 1979.
Wow, that's amazing.
Wow is correct. Because people are taught that people came to America for freedom of religion. And then the original people on whose land they are on did not have that right until the late 70s. That's a little bit odd.
Why do you think that was? Do you think it was a fear-based thing?
That may have contributed to it. I believe that at one time we were 100% of the population in this country, and today we make up less than 2%. But we are still here, and we still practice our religion, our spirituality, our ceremonies and dances and songs on traditional lands. And for me, that's a reason for living.
Yes, very worthwhile reason. I think also with what perhaps Westerners think of more traditional religions such as Christianity, you know, sometimes being very close to nature can feel associated with some sort of paganism or whatever. But I think that some of the greatest poets who were also Christian poets, you know, have really written so much about nature and finding God in nature, whatever, you know, one's particular perspective of God is, that I don't really see a conflict between, you know, in fact, how can you have any relationship with God if you're not engaging with nature?
That's certainly a way to look at it. You answer that question for me.
Yeah. Well, I think it's so important, and I want to talk more about specifically how you came to have Indian Canyon, and also about an upcoming event that you have. But we're going to go to some messages now, and right after that, we'll be back with Anne-Marie Sayers. Keep it here on It's the Way of Love Live on KSCO AM 1080.
Hi, this is Dean Sutton of Sutton Law Firm. We'd like to invite you to consider Sutton Law Firm to help you with your legal problems. Our phone number is 831-431-6483. We emphasize property law, contracts, and business litigation and transactions, evictions, problems with co-ownership, and advice concerning title. Make it easy on your heirs if something happens to you. If your property's in joint tenancy or you have payable on death accounts, you can save your heirs a lot of trouble. Sutton Law Firm, 831-431-6483.
For the last 60 years, Coast Paper and Supply has been serving locals and businesses for all their cleaning and paper supply needs. With an 1,800-square-foot showroom and nearly 5,000 products, you'll find everything you're looking for in the way of janitorial supplies, retail and industrial packaging, and disposable food service products for business or home. Not to mention their huge selection of boxes and shipping supplies. Their family-owned and operated business is located at 151 Josephine on River Street in Santa Cruz. Call 831-423-3350 or visit Coast Paper Supply. Inc.com, a proud member of Think Local First.
Don't miss Celebrity Gossip with Jeff and Rosie every Thursday at 8:15 on Good Morning Monterey Bay.
Matt Lauer has remained relatively quiet about his allegedly frosty relationship with ousted Today Show co-anchor Ann Curry. But he's had plenty to say about his other colleagues. To quote, I think every man in America was and is powerfully attracted to Katie Couric. He said, I have a different relationship with Meredith Vieira. I constantly want to hug her, he says. Whereas he said, my relationship with Al Roker is different still.
Really creepy.
Anytime there's a broom closet and some Quaaludes, Al and I... Oh, wait, no. Sorry. Oh, my God. I'm not going to read the rest of this. There's oven mitts and soy sauce involved. I'm going to stop. I'm going to stop right here. We don't want to think about Al Roker in these terms, surely.
That's Celebrity Gossip with Jeff and Rosie and the gang every Thursday at 8:15 on Good Morning Monterey Bay. Come for the info, stay for the fun on KSEO AM 1080.
Hi, you're listening to It's the Way of Love Live with me, Ruth Copland. I'm talking currently to Anne-Marie Sayers, who's the caretaker of Indian Canyon. And I wanted listeners to know that if you would like to know more about it, you can go to IndianCanyonLife.org, O-R-G. And Anne-Marie, for our listeners who are not familiar with Indian Canyon, can you tell us something about its history and your personal association with it?
Well, I was born and raised here, and I'm 64 years old, and I've opened up my great-grandpa, oh, boy.
Oh, dear. Is that your fax line?
I don't believe so. My apologies.
Well, I'm thinking maybe we should call you back and get a better line. So if you hang up, Anne-Marie, and we'll call you back, okay?
I think it's fine.
Oh, it's gone now? Okay, great.
Oh, I certainly... No.
I'm
back.
Okay, all right, we'll call you back.
Okay.
So we'll get Anne-Marie back in a moment, but if you were listening earlier, you would have heard that Indian Canyon is the only federally recognized Indian country for 300 miles along coastal California. So it's a pretty special place, and Anne-Marie went to incredible lengths to actually get Indian Canyon signed back to her family, and hopefully she's going to tell us a bit about that. And we're also going to be talking about an event that they've got coming up on the 13th of July. It's the 17th annual Indian Canyon Storytelling. And it's from 1 to 5 p.m. There'll be Native American storytellers, dancers, singers, poets. And it's a fabulous event. Again, that's the 13th of July, 1 to 5 p.m., the 17th Annual Indian Canyon Storytelling. And you can find out more about it at IndianCanyonLife.org. And participants travel hundreds of miles to attend ceremonies at Indian Canyon. And in addition to the California Native peoples using the site, spiritual teachers and tribal members from the Southwest, the Plains, Canada, and the East Coast come to do ceremony at Indian Canyon. And also indigenous people from all over the world, Maori from New Zealand, Australian Aborigines, Sami people from Finland, people from Mexico, Central America, South America, and more. And Indian Canyon is a living Indian heritage area. And Anne-Marie believes that ceremony holds a crucial place in the life of all people. It's the expression and continuation of our relationship to the earth and our own history. And ceremony is an anchor for identity with tribes, families, and individuals. And they also have interns from University of California, Santa Cruz, JFK University, San Francisco State, UCLA, who come and receive college units for their studies there, which is also a fabulous way for academics to come and really experience the magic of Indian Canyon. So I think we have Anne-Marie back now. Are you there, Anne-Marie?
Yes, I am.
Yay! So you were just saying how you grew up in Indian Canyon.
Yes, and I couldn't wait to get out of here and left. And then I wanted to come back to build a log cabin on my great-grandfather's home site, which was not on the property that was inherited. It was under the Bureau of Land Management. It was government land. And we used the Indian Allotment Act of 1887 to reclaim it. And it was 8 years of jumping through hoops. We had less than 3% chance of meeting the requirements. And with the help of many people here in San Benito County, red, white, black, and yellow, and I might add also many people from Santa Cruz and Monterey areas, that we were successful and received a trust patent in 1988. And we're still here.
That's amazing. I was reading about that whole process, and your tenacity was amazing because it was incredibly difficult, as you said, and part of it was making the land able to support an Indian family. Is that correct?
That is accurate. Via grazing without irrigation.
Right, which seems might be slightly challenging in a canyon.
That is accurate, particularly when it is exact a mile-long canyon, and it is, so there's seven waterfalls here, of which they are all dry right now, and four are usually, year-round. We are in a drought, but the water will come back.
Well, I was looking at video and photographs on your website. It looks an incredibly beautiful place, and you do have some events that are open to the public, I understand. And I was telling the listeners while we were getting you back on the phone that you have coming up the 17th Annual Indian Canyon Storytelling. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. It's next Saturday at 1 o'clock, and the storytellers and the hoop dancers and the dancers that will be here are unbelievably amazing. Eddie Mandrell, he's a professor at San Francisco State University. He is a hoop dancer, and he's absolutely truly incredible. And then we have Karina Gould, who is an Ohlone storyteller, and she talks about sacred spaces and places. Alan Spirenhawk Salazar, he's Shumash, and he's an incredible storyteller. And we have youth, Russ Kadee, Anthony Saul, and Mashika, who gives the Native American perspective, which is just, it does my heart so, I can feel my heart expand when I listen to the wisdom of the youth of our native peoples. Lakota Hardin. And then there'll also be food available, and then the audience for those who would like to become a part of the dancers and dance. So it's an amazing storytelling. It's, I think, one of our best lineups we've ever had, although everyone's been so good in the past 17 years. But I'm just really looking forward to it. I would love to see you here.
Well, I definitely will try and come. It's July 13th. Is that a Saturday?
It's Saturday from 1 until around 6.
Well, I'm definitely going to put that on my calendar and try and make that something that I attend. And it's, you're near Hollister, is that right?
That is correct. We are off of San Diego Road. You can just Google 1 Indian Canyon Road or MapQuest 1 Indian Canyon Road, and there'll be plenty of signs. If you can find Hollister, you'll find Indian Canyon.
And if listeners are wanting to come to this event, can they buy a ticket in advance? Should they buy a ticket in advance, or can they come on the day? How is the best way to go about that?
Whatever way they so desire. You can go to our website, IndianCanyonLife.org, and then just go to events. Or you can call 831-637-4238 and make reservations, and you can show up the day of the event. But if you make reservations, that does help. But whichever works for you, we would love to see you.
So it helps you in terms of knowing how many people to expect and prepare
exactly,
for.
And how much food that we should have.
Right, yes, yeah. That would be very helpful, I imagine. Well, I would encourage listeners to go to this because it's one of few opportunities during the year where you can actually gain access to Indian Canyon as a member of the public, and it really is a fabulous place. I was wondering, Anne-Marie, if you could tell us a bit more about how storytelling or what part storytelling plays in your culture.
A very important part. Usually there are lessons and there's morals to the story, and the story, I can recall my mother sharing stories with me, and one story, 55 years later, I still remember it as though she had told it yesterday. And stories are for everyone. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and they weave reality and morals into the story as it's being told.
And I think, in sort of Western fairy tales, they're very archetypal. I mean, you have the princess and the prince, and but really it's more about those figures as inner figures within us. Is that something that also comes into Native American storytelling, that it's symbolic also of parts of us?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. That you are a part of the story that is being told when it's being told.
And
come Saturday and you'll understand exactly what I'm talking about.
I've got to find out. And everyone who's listening, we'll all find out exactly. And I was just interested, is it the passing down of stories only, or are storytellers that are allowed to originate their own new stories?
They're both.
Right.
They're both. Some are traditional stories. There may be a creation story. And there will be contemporary stories. And there'll be one gentleman, Ruskadi, he's Pomo, and he does a rap story that shares the reality of our mother and how we must care for her today.
Interesting. Now, you are one of the caretakers of Indian Canyon, and I understand, is your daughter Canyon, spelt with a K, is she also one of the caretakers? Did I get that right?
Yes, she is. She and people that live here, they are all caretakers. Canyon is an artist. She just graduated from the Art Institute of California, and she did the website, IndianCanyonLife.org, and She will sing the grandmother song at the opening of the event, and just an amazing woman. And I'm so grateful because she's so into this high tech that she makes me look good as though I really know what I'm doing.
It's always useful to have someone like that.
Oh, is it ever?
I think we all need that little tech angel person in this age.
I do. And I do have it, and I'm so grateful. I'm one of the luckiest mothers in the world.
Oh, well, that's lovely. And is Indian Canyon on Facebook? Can people link up with you there?
I believe so. That's a question you should ask Canyon. I know I'm on Facebook, and I believe Indian Canyon is on Facebook, on Tweet, on Twitter, and on there's some other things that she's brought to my attention.
I'm looking here, actually. Yeah, it does say follow us on Facebook. So anyone out there who wants to can follow Indian Canyon on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Vimeo also. It's on. I have a sort of like quasi understanding of these technical things. I'm just moving into all of that more in depth myself, Anne-Marie. So I don't have a little angel canyon to help me. So you're very lucky. Well, thank you so much for making the time to come and talk to us today. And I just want to plug that event again. 17th Annual Indian Canyon Storytelling, 13th of July, 1 to 5 p.m. Sounds like it's going to be a phenomenal event, a chance to see native performers, but also to experience the energy of the canyon. Is that true too? Are people able to just spend a little time, you know, wandering, or is it?
Yes.
Yeah, they are.
Yes, certainly welcome. Yes.
Oh, that would be wonderful. So I do hope to see you there myself too. I'm definitely going to pencil that in. So I'll let you know if I'm coming, and I encourage listeners to come. And thank you again for breaking off from your day of ceremony to come on the show. I really appreciate that.
It's been my pleasure, Ruth.
Well, take care, and I hope to see you next week.
Excellent.
All right. Bye-bye, Anne-Marie.
Yes, sir.
Listening to It's the Way of Love Live with me, Ruth Copland. And that does sound like a wonderful event to get in tune with nature and with ourselves through nature. We're going to move on after the commercial break to talk to Deborah Allen, who is a local producer, film producer, and screenplay writer. And she has a film that she is currently hoping to get into production called Jane. And sadly, somewhere in America, a woman is raped every 2 minutes. And today, nearly 40% of the women raped are between the ages of 14 and 17. And most of these girls tell no one. And embedded into the film Jane are the steps needed for girls and their families to prevent certain kinds of trauma, and if they can't, how to begin healing from them. And Jane, the film, reminds all of us that no one can deprive us of our essential wholeness. And it all starts with a story. It's based on a true story, and the story is about a fiercely independent 15-year-old Jane Stewart who wants to be a poet. And she's living with her romance novel writing aunt Claire and feels like she's living inside a Hallmark card until Alex Martin comes into her life. Sexy, gorgeous, funny, and famous. He seems to have it all. He seems to understand her need to create. It all seems wonderful. until he creates chaos by raping her. Can Jane find justice in a courtroom, or will she find another path to redemption? And besides, is it even really considered rape when a celebrity does it? Well, all these things are considered in the film Jane, and we're going to be talking to Deborah Allen more about it after these messages. So stay with us. You're with It's the Way of Love Live with me, Ruth Copeland.
My name is John Lundgren. I've been managing and selling income property in Santa Cruz County for the past 25 years. Do you have residential or light commercial rental property in the Santa Cruz area? Would you like to take the worries and pressures of managing your property off of your shoulders and place those concerns onto my shoulders? Well, I'm ready. I'm a licensed California real estate agent with Karen Properties at your service from the Harbor Lights to Summit Road, Moss Landing to Davenport, and all that's in between. Please call anytime. Weekends and evenings are fine. John Lundgren, area 831-475-RENT. That's 831-475-7368.
Where the sun hits the water and the mountains meet the sand, there's a beach that I walk along sometimes.
Coast Paper and Supply has been family-owned and operated since 1948. They have a wide array of products available, including brand name and eco-friendly cleaning supplies, paper goods, and compostable plates, cups, and cutlery. Whether your needs are for business or home, Coast Paper and Supply's friendly and reliable staff have what you're looking for. They even accommodate special orders. You can find them at 151 Josephine on River Street in Santa Cruz, Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 4:30, or call at 831-423-3350. Coast Paper and Supply is a proud member of Think Local First.
Hey, Steph.
Yes, Sean.
I have two things to tell you. One, you look fabulous today.
I look fabulous every day. What else?
Well, Steph, on this week's show, we will be discussing all things youth and chatting with local students as well.
Excellent. Listen to Out in Santa Cruz, Saturdays at 7 p.m. I'm Steph.
And I'm Sean.
And you've been queered.
I feel sick. Sick at heart, my mind slips into the dark, my soul burns with the pain, my heart yearns, don't lie again, I don't know
You're back with It's the Way of Love Live with me, Ruth Copeland, on KSCO AM 1080. And before the break, I was talking about how we were going to be speaking with Deborah Allen about her film, Jane. which is about a young 15-year-old girl who suffers sexual trauma and how she goes about healing herself and making herself whole again and empowering herself after that experience. And that song you just heard is called Phoenix. It's actually one of my own songs, and I just thought it was quite appropriate for the subject matter that we were going to be discussing today. And we have Deborah on the line with us today. Thank you so much for joining us, Deborah.
Hi, Ruth. I'm glad to be here.
So you're local, you're in Santa Cruz, and you're doing this great film. I did a little synopsis of it before the break. And we want to be sure that we let people know that there's an upcoming fundraising event going on locally on July the 20th that people can attend. But first of all, maybe you'd like to tell me what motivated you to want to write this film and get it made.
You know, it really, as I think most good stories do, unfortunately, there's usually a drama attached to it. You know, something happens. And for me, I was raped when I was 15 by someone that I really trusted. And it, of course, changed the trajectory of my life. And so I went on, you know, and lived the life that I've had, half in the theater and half as a counselor. And somewhere in my 50s, with another woman friend, Elizabeth Roden, we began to try to put it into story form. And Jane came out of that with my really deep belief that there wasn't enough happening for girls in film that talked about how do you heal after something horrible happens. You know, so often the media approach to rape and to sexual assault has been to leave the girl with the horrible event and never following up what happens later. So this is a film about a young girl that finds her way home, and sort of embedded in the film through the action of the story are all sorts of wonderful ways that other people help her. She learns to fight. She learns to fight back. She learns to say no. And she also keeps her own inner life alive, which for most of us who've been traumatized, that sort of line to our creative source is one of the ways that can keep us on track, is that I'm a whole person no matter what bad has happened to me. So I wanted to write a story that would bring a child home and not leave her where I felt that I got left, because it was still at a time in the culture when no one was talking about it. And so that's where the story came from, and then it's come a long, long way.
I think it's a disturbing and difficult subject area for people to address, because I know there's a lot about stranger danger, and my son at school, you know, was given classes sort of kid power, you know, to empower yourself. And it's kind of unspoken, talking about the fact that I don't know the exact statistic, but most attacks, or a large number of attacks, are carried out by people that people know and trust. And it's an awkward kind of subject to address, but I think when you consider how many people must have experienced assault in some form or other, or at least must know someone, it's an incredibly important subject to try and bring out into the open in a positive way.
Well, you know what? This is the funniest thing happened, and this was like, you know, on the glass half full side that was really exciting, is we had a chance to go down and talk to 8 young actors, up and coming actresses in Hollywood, and have them read for Jane for the main part. And the really wonderful thing that happened for me was that not only these young girls who were all 15 to 18, but their mothers and their agents all wanted them to play the part. And basically what they said is that there just isn't enough out there that shows young, smart, interesting, alive, awake girls. And it's not an abstract thing. You know, if it's happening to 1 in 4 girls before the age of 18, that's a lot of us.
Yeah, it really is. And I would recommend listeners going to YouTube and watching Deborah Allen's rant for Jane. It's very interesting. She goes through all different films and how they approach the subject of women's assault and empowerment or not. And I think, you know, what you were pointing out is that often characters in films, they're left disempowered, or the way they fight back is not by making themselves whole. It's by through extreme acts, either, you know, whether it be committing suicide themselves or going and, you know, killing the person who did it. But it's not actually showing how to make yourself whole again if you go through something like that.
That's right. And that's the place where I think that our film has a really particular niche right now. I was reading the New People magazine today, bless its heart, and they did an article on this young girl who's just broke my heart from Nova Scotia, who was raped, and then it was posted on cell phones all through her school, and she killed herself.
Yeah.
And they reposted the article about her today, and once again, it just, you know, my heart just broke, because it left the reader after three glossy pages with no idea of what kind of intervention might have helped. It's just not fair. It's not fair to me, to those girls, to leave them without any information.
No.
And so I wanted to get it to them in story form. She's a heroine, you know. She's feisty and she's strong, and she gets hurt and she gets beaten down to the bottom, and then she rises back up like your song, The Phoenix. And that's what I want our girls. That's what I would have wanted for me.
Yeah, and part of, I think, what you've spoken about is having trusted whole adults to help you through that as well. It is very important.
Men and women. You know, there's great guys in my film, too. You know, this is always such a really tough subject, I think, for men to listen to, because for whatever the reasons are, for the history of, you know, of humanity, you know, 99% of the perpetrators are men. And yet there's, you know, many thousands and billions more fabulous men that are standing up and saying, not on our watch. So it's a tough subject. You know, it has so much shadow in it. It has so much pain and fear. What's astonished me when I read about these young kids is that, you know, the girls are getting the blame for it. It's just absolutely mind-boggling. And so I'm particularly proud of the town of Santa Cruz and Scotts Valley and, you know, the Women's Council of Realtors, who's throwing the benefit for us. Bruce Canepa, the car designer. I mean, this whole community group standing up and saying, we believe that we can help change the culture of rape by telling a good story and by giving girls heroines, because this is not on my watch. And I love feeling the whole, my sort of thing for this is there's a community making a movie, you know. It's exciting.
Well, I think, you know, there's an element of scapegoating that goes on in these kind of assaults. And you were saying how often the girl can feel like it's their fault, either that they didn't stop it or that they invited it in some way. And
right.
I think, you know, it's so easy when you feel disjointed from the people around you to do that, to point the finger and just shove it over there and say it's nothing to do with me. So I think what you're saying is wonderful, that the community is coming together. And you've got a good quote on your website from former California State Senator Joe Simishian, I think you pronounce
uh-huh,
that.
Uh-huh.
Its audience is every teenager, everyone who has ever been a teenager, and everyone who loves a teenager. And I think that's so important. You know, some men change their attitude towards women completely when they have a daughter. And I think that if we could try and help that understanding of women to happen earlier, you know, so that it doesn't take you having to have your own daughter to really go, oh, now I see.
Right.
That would be positive.
And because we know now that, you know, that rape is not a sexual crime, it's a crime of violence.
Exactly.
That all of the rage and anger that's coming, you know, through the system is pouring into the system. And there's so much that we have to do. And I guess I feel like this is the piece that I can do, because this is the only story I can tell. I'm really trusting that more stories, positive healing stories, are coming. I just know that we're right in the pipeline. We're ready to go. We have a fabulous script, a great crew. We're ready to cast. So, and we want to film here. So that's an exciting for us moment. We didn't, you know, it's taken some years for people to even be able to consider making a film like this, even though it's really pretty upbeat around how she heals, it's still a really tough subject.
Why do you think it is so tough for people? Just because people would rather think it doesn't actually happen, or?
I think so, and I think because there's so much body fear for us, for the women, there's so much, I don't know, one of my friends told me she had her car stolen, and she wrote to me, she's so sweet because she's working on Jane, and she said, you know, I know this isn't like a rape, but it's a violation. And I thought, God, that's just such a sweet note, because I think everybody, if you think about it, can begin to understand what it would feel like to have something coming into you that you don't want there.
Yes.
And it's so, there's so much disturbance emotionally, and so much shame, and so much fear, and so much lack of control. I mean, it's just a part of our society we just don't talk about. We don't talk about difficult emotions easily. And so it's hard to create an honest film about it, that it doesn't make someone either all good or all bad.
Yeah. And I think also we've come a long way and still probably need to go further with the idea of rape not being necessarily in a dark alley where somebody, you know, holds a gun or a knife to you and horribly, you know, beats you up or whatever. That I mean, I don't like using the word date rape, because I think even that minimalizes what actually happens when a person is forced to have sexual intercourse when they don't want to. But I think that too, it's sort of culturally there's this sense of, like, I think in your notes it says, you know, is it really rape if a celebrity does it? It's sort of the same thing. Is it really rape if your boyfriend does it, you know?
Right, right. Well, and you know what I've tried to do in the film, because I'm so clear about this, is that, you know, this is a 15-year-old and a 40-year-old.
Right.
This isn't two 15-year-olds. This isn't, you know, there's, it's just, we have to be really clear about what we're talking about. And
someone who really should know better, who's in a position of authority.
Yeah,
and, yeah.
And that, you know, these, there's none of it is acceptable. It's just the story that I could tell. I wanted to make really clear.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I wanted to, because the story's not out there. I think the last, you know, really, gosh, can you even remember, was probably The Accused, which is like 25 years ago. I mean, there's just not been, you know, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is a really violent story, and it's not a teaching story.
No.
And so I wanted to have, we're going to try to take the film into the schools the way that Bullies went into the schools, to have a safe conversation starter story and a curriculum. So I'm hoping that works with the film too, because it's a good film for that. There's each of the characters, you know, you can teach in an English class.
Right, yeah. Well, I want to be sure people know how they can find out more about this. So the website is www.jane-themovie.com. So jane-themovie.com. And then the event that's being held very soon on the 20th of July from 4 to 7 p.m. is Cruisin' to Hollywood with Jane. It's a benefit for the movie organized by the Women's Council of Realtors, the Santa Cruz chapter. And it's at, is it the Canepa Car Collection and Motorsport Museum? And whereabouts is that?
It's in Scotts Valley. It's 4900 Scotts Valley Drive. You can buy tickets at the door. It's the most amazing, he doesn't often open this amazing car collection of his with all of these, you know, Jay Leno cars, and I think it's just a wonderful masculine and feminine mix for the afternoon. And you can also get tickets at www.janebenefit.com.
Okay, that's a good website for everyone then, janebenefit.com.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to try and come to this.
I love cars.
I really like cars. And I think the film is fabulous, and I would really like to support it. So if there's any listeners out there who would like to join with many members of the community who are trying to help this incredibly positive film get made and also have a really fun afternoon, please do come along to this on the 20th of July from 4 to 7. And we're coming to the end of the show now, but I want also to let listeners know that Deborah is going to come back in August on the 24th for a longer session, so that we can talk more about you know, what's behind the film, what she's really trying to do with it. And also we'll get an update on new developments, which will be really,
Ruth, thank you. I'm so grateful to be here with you. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. And thanks for taking the time out to talk to us today.
Okay, and I'll see you at the benefit.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
So we're coming to the end now of It's the Way of Love Live. Raquel and MC will be back next week. And we hope you've enjoyed the show. You're listening to KSCO AM 1080.
Your source for news, sports, traffic, and weather. AM 1080, KSCO, Santa Cruz, San Jose, Salinas, and Monterey.
CBS News, I'm Sam Litzinger. Federal investigators are getting set to look into the deadly crash of a South Korean jumbo jet. At least two people were killed and dozens hurt when the plane crashed on landing and began burning in San Francisco. One person still unaccounted for. CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman's at the airport.
As members of the National Transportation Safety Board head here to San Francisco, the investigation is already underway. The remnants of the charred jumbo jet are still on the runway. This man was here at the airport waiting for his wife and daughter when suddenly he received a call from his wife.
She said that she was crying. She said, we just crashed. We rolled over. There's a big fire behind us, and I'm really scared.
The big question still remains why this happened. Weather conditions do not appear to have been a factor. Steve Futterman, CBS News, at San Francisco International Airport.
The mayor of Lac-Mégantic in Quebec says the center of the lakeside town has been all but destroyed after a train derailed, setting off several explosions and fires. CJAD radio reporter Todd Vanderheiden says at least one person was killed, several others reported missing.
The train had 73 cars in it. It was carrying crude oil to the state of Maine. When it derailed, there were a series of explosions that happened right after that, and just a major, major fire that burned throughout the night, well into the daylight.
The town's close to the border with Maine and Vermont, about 150 miles east of Montreal. Egypt's new president is now backing away from an announcement that pro-reform leader Mohamed al-Baradei would be the interim prime minister. CBS News correspondent Clarissa Ward.
There's been a lot of confusion here in Egypt about whether or not Nobel Peace Prize winner Mohamed al-Baradei is the country's new prime minister. The spokesman for the interim president gave a press conference in which he said that al-Baradei's name was just one in a list of candidates that the president was considering, and that while al-Baradei may seem like the most logical choice, no appointment has in fact been made.
Officials say mediation is underway. Not much new to report on the condition of ailing human rights icon Nelson Mandela. CBS News correspondent Deborah Pattis says the international vigil continues.
The official government position remains critical but stable, but what that actually means is really become something of a national obsession in South Africa, with every new piece of the puzzle being scrutinized and analyzed. Earlier this week, the family said there were signs of improvement. Nelson Mandela's wife, Graca Michelle, said her husband is sometimes uncomfortable but seldom in pain.
South African government denies Mandela's being kept alive by machines. She's won her first major title, and it's a big one. French player Marion Bartoli defeated Sabine Lisicki 6-1, 6-4 in the women's final at Wimbledon. The victory comes 6 years after Bartoli lost to Venus Williams at the All England Club. Remembering that loss, Bartoli had kind words for her opponent, telling Lisicki she would no doubt get another chance at a title. This is CBS News.
This is an important message for all hardworking Americans. Not long ago, Michael Parnas was living on a park bench in New York City. Fast forward to 2008, he took a few thousand dollars, and in less than 8 months, eight of the worst trading months in stock market history, Michael made close to $4 million. He cracked the stock market's code and discovered the insider trends that your broker doesn't want you to know. So he is giving you his Power Trading, Power Living book and DVD to help take the mystery out of the market, break down the trades and trends you need to know, and show you how he went from a park bench to Park Avenue for free. Just pay shipping. Michael has never stopped believing that regular hardworking people can make money in the stock market. A lot of money. In fact, Michael is convinced power trading can work for you too. That's why he's giving you his book and DVD for free. Call Michael now at 1-800-845-2417 and claim your free copy. Call 1-800-845-2417. That's 1-800-845-2417. Trading carries a high level of risk and may not be suitable for everyone.
It's an annual tradition in Pamplona, Spain. And reporter Steve Dorsey says both humans and non-humans are busy taking part.
Thousands of people wearing traditional white clothes with red sashes packed into downtown Pamplona Saturday morning. Nearly everyone was drenched in sangria. Under a shower of confetti, the town's mayor then set off several fireworks, which signaled the start to the festivities. The first bull run is scheduled for Sunday morning through the town's narrow streets and to its bull ring. Steve Dorsey for CBS News, Pamplona.
It's an all-points bulletin for a bald eagle. Officials at the Baton Rouge Zoo in Louisiana say a male eagle turned into an escape artist by breaking a hole in its mesh enclosure and flying away. Zoo officials would like to have him back because he was found injured in the woods, and he actually has trouble flying. Sam Litzinger, CBS News.
Good evening, Central Coast. You're listening to KSCO AM 1080 Santa Cruz and KOMY 1340 Watsonville. The time is 7:05, and I'm Sam Quentin with your King of the Hill traffic and weather. We'll start off in the San Jose area, U.S. 101 southbound at McKee Road. We have an accident with the shoulder block. That's a two-vehicle accident there. CHP is on the scene. And in the Campbell area, Highway 17 southbound at Hamilton Avenue, we have a possible car fire on the right-hand shoulder. CHP is on the scene there. Elsewhere on Highway 17, it's looking pretty good now. Most of the beach traffic has made their way over the hill. You'll find southbound Highway 1 moving at the limit as well through 41st Avenue. And we have some slowdowns on Highway 183 and Merritt Street. And speeds are around 8 to 10 miles per hour there in the eastbound lane on 183. Elsewhere, let's see what we have. In the Monterey area, Bluff Road and Jensen Road, we have a truck.